WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Kylie Worth with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, 4th of July. On Wednesday night, the first immigrant detainees of what could eventually be 5,000 arrived at the swamp camp Florida officials call Alligator Alcatraz. Yesterday, the Florida Department of Emergency Management tweeted that the first group had arrived and that Florida is proud to help facilitate Donald Trump's mission to enforce immigration law. Workers were seen installing a sign that read Alligator Alcatraz along the dead-end road leading to the tent camp in the middle of the Big Cypress National Preserve in the Everglades. Florida will soon attempt to open its second immigration center following this 4th of July. The plan is to use existing infrastructure at Camp Blanding, the main training base for the Florida National Guard. Florida is hoping to hold at least 2,000 detainees at this potential facility. Camp Blanding has an airfield that the state is planning to use to deport detained immigrants to their country of origin, but it doesn't end there. Governor Ron DeSantis says that if the state were to open a third detention center, it would likely be built in the Panhandle. He describes these sites as one-stop shops. The U.S. House of Representatives has given final approval on Donald Trump's mega spending bill that the president is expected to sign by the end of today. Healthcare providers and policy experts say that the bill will cut $4 billion in funding to Florida's Medicaid, which could have a significant effect on residents of Sarasota and Manatee County. Sarasota County has nearly twice as many nursing homes as the state average. Medicaid pays for 58% of all nursing home residents in the state. The Congressional Budget Office reported that the bill will cause nearly 11 million Americans to lose insurance coverage through 2034, many of which reside in the state of Florida. Cuts to Medicaid could also cause healthcare providers to shut their doors, particularly those who serve more vulnerable communities. Northport's annual 4th of July celebration, Freedom Festival, has been postponed to August 30th due to weather concerns. The festival was planned to be held at Cool Today Park, the spring training baseball stadium. Forecasts indicate a high probability of lightning and unpredictable weather patterns that could affect fireworks and other planned activities. These conditions led the city of Northport's Recreation Department to make the decision to postpone the festival. Northport Recreation Manager Shelby Mendelson says the safety of residents, staff, and visitors is a top priority. After evaluating every alternative, postponing is the responsible choice. Stay safe this 4th of July. This has been Kylie Worth with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, July 4th.
The following program was pre-recorded in front of an audience of one real live cat. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who with the music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Larini. Thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. Well, happy 4th of July. It is the 249th time Americans are celebrating the signing of the Declaration of Independence, a document which, among other things, proclaimed that all men are created equal, a concept that was revolutionary at the time when a common belief by many was that the king was better than you. Here's to hoping that by the time of the 250th commemoration comes around, the United States of America will still be kingless. One way to ensure that is to let our current leaders know that would be unacceptable by attending one of the many protests scheduled for today, including one in Sarasota at Bayfront Drive that is starting right now at 9 a.m. But it is expected to continue through noon, so, dear listeners, you have time to make your voices heard on this most patriotic of patriotic holidays. However, At the moment, we are suffering under the rule of a dangerous autocrat whose minions in the legislature may have already passed a package of laws and policies that will hurt just about everybody. Stay tuned until half past the hour to hear my conversation with Ethan Frey, a research fellow at Florida Policy Institute, who explains how just one part of the so-called Big Beautiful Bill that rolls back investments in climate and clean energy initiatives from the Biden administration's Inflation Reduction Act will cost Floridians and, in fact, all Americans. But first, hear who has already paid the tariffs and who will pay when they kick in for real, unless, of course, Taco lives up to his name. An analysis finds that a critical group of U.S. employers could now face a direct cost of $82.3 billion from President Donald Trump's current tariff plans, a sum that could be potentially managed through price hikes, layoffs, hiring freezes, or lower profit margins. The analysis by the J.P. Morgan Chase Institute is among the first to measure the direct costs created by the import taxes on businesses with $10 million to $1 billion in annual revenue, a category that includes roughly a third of private sector U.S. workers. These companies are more dependent than other businesses on imports from China, India, and Thailand, and the retail and wholesale sectors would be especially vulnerable to the import taxes being levied by the Republican president. The findings show clear trade-offs from Trump's import taxes, contradicting his claims that foreign manufacturers would absorb the costs of the tariffs instead of U.S. companies that rely on the imports. While tariffs launched under Trump have yet to boost overall inflation, large companies such as Amazon, Costco, Walmart, and Williams-Sonoma delayed the potential reckoning by building up their inventories before the taxes could be imposed. The analysis comes just ahead of the July 9th deadline by Trump to formally set the tariff rates on goods from dozens of countries. Trump's imposed that deadline after the financial markets panicked in response to his April tariff announcements, prompting him to instead schedule a 90-day negotiating period when most imports faced a 10% baseline tariff. China, Mexico, and Canada faced higher rates, and there are separate 50% tariffs on steel and aluminum. And the initial April 2nd tariff stayed in place. The companies in the J.P. Morgan Institute analysis would have faced additional direct costs of $187.6 billion. Under the current rates, the $82.3 billion would be the equivalent to $2,080 per employee, or 3.1% of the average annual payroll. Those averages don't include firms that don't import goods and those that do. Asked Tuesday how trade talks are faring, Trump said simply, "Everything's going well." The president has indicated that he will set tariff rates given the logistical challenge of negotiating with so many nations. As the 90-day period comes to a close, only the United Kingdom has signed a trade framework with the Trump administration. India and Vietnam have signaled that they're close to a trade framework. There is a growing body of evidence suggesting that more inflation could surface. The investment bank Goldman Sachs said in a report that it expects companies to pass along 60% of their tariff cost to consumers. The Atlantic Federal Reserve has used its survey of businesses' inflation expectations to say that companies could, on average, pass along roughly half their costs from a 10% tariff or a 25% tariff without reducing consumer demand. The J.P. Morgan Chase Institute findings suggest that tariffs could cause some domestic manufacturers to strengthen their roles as suppliers of goods, but it noted that companies need to plan for a range of possible outcomes and that wholesalers and retailers already operate on such low profit margins that they might need to spread the tariff costs to their customers. The outlook for tariffs remains highly uncertain. Trump has stopped negotiations with Canada, only to restart them after the company dropped the plan to tax digital services. He similarly on Monday threatened more tariffs on Japan unless it buys more rice from the U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said in a Tuesday interview that the concessions from the trade talks have impressed career officials at the Office of U.S. Trade Representative and other agencies. People who have been in Treasury, at Commerce, at USTR for 20 years are saying that these deals are the best, are like they've never seen before, Bessent said on Fox News Channel's Fox and Friends. Treasury Secretary said the Trump administration plans to discuss the contours of trade deals next week, prioritizing the tax cuts package passed on Tuesday by the Republican majority in the Senate. Hurricane season is here, and thanks to DOGE, Floridians will be less informed about imminent storms. The Defense Department is cutting off weather forecasters from data gathered by its special satellites that can see through the clouds, a move experts say could deprive researchers of key information as hurricane season kicks into gear. It's just going to make researchers have to work even harder to get results, said Jill Trepanier, a hurricane climatologist and chair of Louisiana State University's Department of Geography and Anthropology. The permanent cutoff puts to a stop the distribution of all data collected by three military-run satellites, according to a notice released June 25th by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The Pentagon first announced the data cutoff would take effect June 30th, but later pushed the date back to July 31st. The Navy confirmed the data cutoff, adding that satellite program was already scheduled for discontinuation in September of 2026. Launched in 2003 and 2009, the satellites orbit Earth every 101 minutes at an altitude of about 515 miles, according to NASA. They track weather patterns over remote areas, including fog, severe thunderstorms, dust and sandstorms, and tropical cyclones, according to the Space Force. The satellites are equipped with unique tools to peer beneath cloud cover and capture microwave images that forecasters can't get anywhere else. Their infrared sensors capture images over wide areas, beaming down information twice a day. The Space Force said the Navy was responsible for the change. Even as the Navy is making a change on their end, the posture on sharing data has not changed, the Space Force said in a statement. The satellites and the instruments are still functional, and the Defense Department users will continue to receive and operationally use data from them. Hurricane experts were already raising alarms about the impact of the Trump administration's slashing of science budgets could have on hurricane research. The satellite data cutoff could exacerbate the problem, they say. We're back to tracking hurricanes like it's 1999, except this isn't a party, and people could die. John Morales, a three-decade TV meteorologist specializing in hurricanes, wrote in an op-ed, NBC op-ed. The military satellites provide critical information that regular weather satellites can't. The change will severely impede and downgrade hurricane forecasts for the season and beyond, affecting tens of millions of Americans. Michael Lowry, hurricane specialist and storm surge expert, wrote in a Substack article. The three military-run satellites provide roughly half of the microwave satellite scans to forecasters, Lowry wrote. Trepanier said the data from the satellites helps track rapid intensification of hurricanes and lets scientists see a structure as the storm is forming, which today represents probably the weakest piece in the modeling puzzle. The biggest threats was the suddenness of the shutdown, which left researchers reeling, Trepanier said. Forecasters are also watching Hurricane Flossie, which formed in the eastern Pacific and continues to strengthen off the coast of southwest Mexico. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. The predicted lack of pickers for our food will soon affect the food supply at the grocery store, as well as the cost of said grocery. Lisa Tate is a sixth-generation farmer in Ventura County, California, an area that produces billions of dollars worth of fruit and vegetables each year, much of it hand-picked by immigrants in the U.S. illegally. Tate knows the farms around her well, and she says she can see with her own eyes how raids carried out in June by agents from U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement in the area's fields, part of President Donald Trump's migration crackdown, have frightened off workers. In the fields, I would say 70% of the workers are gone, she said. If 70% of your workforce doesn't show up, 70% of your crop doesn't get picked and can go bad in one day. Most Americans don't want to do this work. Most farmers here are barely breaking even. I fear this has created a tipping point where many will go bust. In the vast agricultural lands of Los Angeles, stretching from Ventura County into the state's Central Valley, two farmers, two field supervisors, and four immigrant farm workers told Reuters that the ICE raids have led to a majority of workers to stop showing up. That means crops are not getting picked and fruit and vegetables are rotting at peak harvest time, they said. One Mexican farm supervisor who asked not to be named was recently overseeing a field being prepared for planting strawberries. Usually he would have 300 workers, he said. On that day, he had just 80. Another supervisor at a different farm said he usually has 80 workers in the field, but just 17 that day. Most economists and politicians acknowledge that many of Americans' agricultural workers are in the country illegally, but say a sharp reduction in their numbers could have devastating impacts on the food supply chain and farm belt economies. Douglas Holtz Eakin, a Republican and former director of the Congressional Budget Office, said an estimated 80% of farm workers in the United States were foreign-born, and nearly half of them in the country are illegally. Losing them would cause price hikes for consumers, he said. This is bad for supply chains, bad for the agricultural industry, Holtz Eakin said. Over a third of U.S. vegetables and over three-quarters of the country's fruits and nuts are grown in California, according to the California Department of Food and Agriculture. The state's farms and ranches generated nearly $60 billion in agricultural sales in 2023. Of the four immigrant farm workers Reuters spoke to, two are in the country illegally. These two spoke in the condition of anonymity, out of fear of being arrested by ICE. One, age 54, has worked in U.S. agricultural fields for 30 years and has a wife and children in the country. He said most of his colleagues have stopped showing up for work. They show up for work. They don't know if they'll ever see their family again, he said. The other worker in the country illegally told Reuters, basically, we wake up in the morning scared. We worry about the sun, the heat, and now a much bigger problem, many not returning home. I try not to get in trouble on the street. Now, whoever gets arrested for any reason gets deported. To be sure, some farm worker community groups have said that workers were still returning to the fields despite the raids out of economic necessity. The days following the raid may see decreased attendance in the field, but workers soon return because they have no other sources of income, five groups told Reuters. Workers are also taking steps to reduce their exposure to immigration agents, like carpooling with people with legal status to work or sending U.S. citizen children to the grocery store, the group said. Trump conceded in a post on Truth Social account in June that ICE raids on farm workers and also hotel workers were taking very good long-time workers away from those sectors, with jobs being almost impossible to replace. Trump later told reporters, "Our farmers are being hurt badly, and they're very good workers," he added. "They're not citizens, but they've turned out to be great." He pledged to issue an order to address the impact, but no policy change has been enacted. Bernard Yaros, a leading U.S. economist at the Oxford Economics, a nonpartisan global economic advisory firm, said that in a report published on June 26th, that native-born workers tend not to fill the void left by immigrant workers who have left. unauthorized immigrants tend to work in different occupations than those who are native-born, he said. ICE operations in California's farmland were scaring even those who are authorized, said Greg Tisch, who runs a farm in Central California. Nobody feels safe when they hear the word ICE, even the documented people. We know that this neighborhood is full of a combination of those with and without documents, Tisch said. We need the labor. Reporting the news may soon become an illegal activity. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem said journalists at CNN may have committed prosecutable offenses by doing basic reporting. On Monday, CNN reported on an app that allows users to report sightings of Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents. Since President Donald Trump took office, ICE has carried out scores of raids to search for undocumented immigrants. In response, Joshua Aaron, a developer, created an app called IceBlock. In addition to publishing a straightforward news article about IceBlock on its website, CNN also reported on the app on air. On Tuesday's Hannity on Fox News, Sean Hannity suggested that both the app and reporting about the app are illegal. Before doing, he aired a snippet of CNN's segment about it. I talked with Joshua Aaron, a longtime tech worker who developed the platform, CNN's Claire Duffy said in the segment, and he said he wants it to be an early warning system for people about the location of Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers. So, he says, he does not want people interfering with those officers' activities, but he does want people to be able to avoid them altogether. You open the app, and it looks like a map, and users can tap the map to report an ICE sighting in their area, and then everybody who uses the platform within 5 miles of the sighting will get a push alert. This is a free iPhone app. It is anonymous, Aaron said, and he does not collect any user data. Hannity responded by citing ICE statistics claiming that assaults against ICE agents have risen nearly 700% in the last year. It is unclear how many of these alleged assaults are being prosecuted. Donning a gaudy Make America Great Again hat with gold-colored lettering, Noem joined the program where the host asked, are they not aiding and abetting in their law-breaking? Are they not responsible for obstructing justice? He also added that Attorney General Pam Bondi told him she is examining whether the app and the reporting about it are illegal. Yes, absolutely, Noem replied. I believe in my opinion that they are, and that's why I'm so thrilled that Pam is willing to be proactive and go after those individuals who would perpetrate that kind of activity against our law enforcement officers. And to have someone like CNN openly describing how to use the technology to reveal the activities and the operations that these law enforcement folks are trying to conduct, it's shameful. And it could be prosecutable, she said. So I'm glad Pam is looking into it. Earlier that day, Noem and Trump said they were looking into whether they can criminally charge CNN for its reporting on ICE and also Trump's bombing of Iran last month. No enemies list from he who would be king. Check out who's been threatened in just the last week. CNN aired the long list of people and groups that President Donald Trump has targeted in the past 48 to 72 hours this week, including former ally Elon Musk, the nation of Japan, and CNN itself. The president's insult parade is crowded tonight, attacking everyone who dares speak out against him or his policies. Here's some of the names that he targeted in just the last 48 to 72 hours, said host Abby Phillip. A graphic was then displayed which showed Musk, Senator Tom Tillis, Senator Thomas Massie, New York City Democratic mayoral candidate Zoran Mamdani, CNN, Japan, AT&T, Israeli prosecutors, Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell, Canada, Forbes, Harvard University, Alligator Alcatraz escapees, and former U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas beneath the caption, people and groups Trump has targeted in the past 48 to 72 hours. The CNN host went on to play a clip of Trump threatening to deport Musk, who threw his support behind the creation of a third party to take on Musk and the Republican Party this week. Asked, "How are you going to deport Elon Musk?" Trump replied, "I don't know. I mean, we'll have to take a look. We have to put Doge on Elon. You know what Doge is. Doge is the monster that might have to go back and eat Elon. Wouldn't that be terrible?" And this is all coming from the president who prides himself on doing this, continues Phillips, before playing a compilation of clips of Trump boasting that he banned all government censorship and restored free speech in America. The upset winner of the New York City Democratic mayoral primary pushes back at the threat to have him deported. Zoran Mondani, the Democratic nominee for New York mayor, has hit back at President Donald Trump's threats to have him deported. "The President of the United States just threatened to have me arrested, stripped of my citizenship, put in a detention camp, and deported. Not because I have broken any law, but because I will refuse to let ICE terrorize our city," he said in a statement. His statements don't just represent an attack on our democracy, but an attempt to send a message to every New Yorker who refuses to hide in the shadows. If you speak up, they will come for you. Newsweek has contacted Mondani's campaign for comment via email outside of normal office hours. Mondani, 33, is a New York City assemblyman who was born in Uganda to Indian parents. He has lived in New York City since the age of 7 and became a U.S. citizen in 2018. Last week, Mondani rocked the Democratic primary after he defeated former Governor Andrew Cuomo, positioning himself as the party's nominee. If elected in November, he would become the city's first Muslim and Indian American mayor. Several Republican lawmakers have called for him to be stripped of his citizenship and deported. However, none have presented any evidence to suggest that Mondani has committed an act that could justify his removal from the United States. During a tour of the new Alligator Alcatraz Migrant Detention Center in Florida on Tuesday, Trump responded to a question about Mondani, saying, "Well, then, we'll have to arrest them. We don't need to have a communist in this country. But if we have one, I'm going to be watching over him very carefully on behalf of the nation." He added, "A lot of people are saying he's here illegally. Ideally, he's going to be less than a communist. But right now, that's a communist. That's a socialist." Mondani, a Democratic socialist, centered his campaign on making life more affordable in New York City with a strong emphasis on rent freezes. His platform also promises free child care, free bus services, and measures to protect the city from the impacts of Trump's policies. Incumbent Mayor Eric Adams, after being indicted on federal corruption charges in September 2024, is seeking re-election as an independent candidate. Other candidates in the race include Republican Curtis Silva and Independent Jim Walden. Representative Andy Ogle said in a post on X, "Zoran Mondani was a card-carrying member of the Democratic Socialists of America when he became a citizen. If he checked no on his N-400 form when asked about associations with the Communist Party, then he lied. Get the plane ready. He might be going back." Senator Bernie Sanders wrote on X, "Mondani won. The establishment is in panic. Billionaires are raising money against him. Trump is ranting. Islamophobes are on the loose. They know what they know. Candidates who stand boldly with the working class can win not only in NYC but anywhere. Let's stand with Zoran." President Donald Trump wrote on Truth Social, "It's finally happened. The Democrats have crossed the line. Zoran Mondani is 100% communist lunatic. Has just won the Dem primary and is on his way to becoming mayor." Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said, "Your dedication is affordable, welcoming, and safe New York City, where working families can have a shot, has inspired people across the city. Billionaires and lobbyists poured millions against you and our public finance system, and you won." You're listening to WSLR, LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, and WBPV, LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Up next is my conversation with Ethan Frey from the Florida Policy Institute.
I'm Lou Larinian. I'm happy to welcome back Ethan Frey, Florida Policy Institute Research Fellow, who's broken down how the cuts to the energy and storm readiness funding in the one big bill would mean higher utility and insurance costs for all Floridians. How you doing, Ethan? How's it going today?
Good, Lou. Thanks for having me on. It's good to talk to you again.
Yeah, you know, at this taping, the so-called one big beautiful bill has not passed, but maybe law by airing. That's going to be Friday. The last time we spoke last year, a discussion covered how Florida was, or I guess was not, using funds from some of the big funding bills passed during the Biden administration, including the Inflation Reduction Act. Now it seems that's not going to matter anymore. First, remind us of what the IRA funding had provided or was supposed to provide Floridians.
Yeah, the Inflation Reduction Act was really intended to do as the title describes. It was an attempt to tackle the cost of living crisis and rising, living costs, especially focused on the energy sector. And given how much energy prices have come down in the last 10, 20 years, for wind and solar, the idea was to transition the energy grid away from dirty, costly fossil fuels and toward cleaner and cheaper, more renewable forms of energy, and, to subsidize some of that transition and use it to, build up a domestic industry that employs more Americans with better jobs. And I think for a state like Florida, it was like, I think I may have described it this way when we spoke last time. I feel like it was a bill written for Floridians. We don't have a fossil fuel industry. We import nearly 80% of the energy we need for the grid in imported natural gas. So that means we're sending billions of dollars to other states to buy energy that we need to make their grid run. And that's a lot of money. And it's jacking up our utility rates, and so the Inflation Reduction Act was kind of a great bill. It was investing in cleaner and more resilient infrastructure that would help people weather storms, that would bring down prices, and that would mean that, for Florida, which had been kind of slow to ramp up its domestic solar industry, it was sort of even better that Florida hadn't done that, because then it meant we could take more of the tax credits and more of the investment in the bill to build up this industry, whereas Texas and Florida and these other states had already gone ahead with that. Florida could really jump on this and take advantage of the bill and bring a lot of federal investment into the state to help create good jobs and make the grid more resilient and other parts of, Florida's infrastructure and save people money.
Yeah, but, that's all in the past. If this bill has passed or is passing, at least in its current form, without, I guess, some sort of unforeseen and dramatic changes in it, once a repeal parts of the IRA that are going to affect Floridians, I guess, at the very least, it's going to jack up their electric bill, which are already increasing due to investor-owned utilities, doing their part. To raise prices. How does that all happen, and what are they trying to, cut out of the IRA?
Yeah. Well, it's worth underscoring, and I'm sure many listeners are aware of this, that, overall the bill, is talking about cutting something like $1 trillion from Medicaid and food assistance, for young children and low-income folks and the elderly, in order to pay for, trillions of dollars of tax cuts for, the already wealthy. So that's, a big part of the bill. And then, lumped in with all that, is, all these cuts to energy and storm readiness funding, which is what my article focuses on. But I just wanted to underscore that because obviously that is so significant.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, nationwide, as you noted, we're talking $500 billion, that they want to cut out, that was
from climate and energy.
On climate and energy, that would be assistance yeah. for Americans, and continue. What chunk of that is going to be affecting Florida?
Yeah. So, what it means for Florida is that, our utilities are going to face higher costs. The largest utility in the country is here in Florida, Florida Power and Light, and its owner, NextEra Energy, is a, highly priced renewable energy stock. Since the initial House bill was introduced, its stock, has taken a beating. And then, has further gone down. And so in a sign of how this is bad for, it's bad for business, it's bad for home, for Florida business, it's bad for Florida homeowners, this is sort of one sign of how bad this is. And the reason it's bad is that, Florida Power and Light is trying to generate more of its electricity here in Florida, and it's building a bunch of utility-scale solar operations, and they've already set forth on a bunch of investments that take years, and they have a plan to generate, I think, is it 90,000 megawatts of solar electricity by 2045, and they've planned this out in their 10-year, investment plan, and they were pricing in a lot of these tax credits that were passed under the Inflation Reduction Act. And if you look at the recent rate cases, Duke Energy Florida also had talked about how it was planning to use $50 million in clean energy tax credits to prevent rates from going up further. And the main reason that this is happening is Florida's utilities rely heavily on imported natural gas. I checked the last energy information website, that tracks all this stuff, and we got 78% of our electricity from imported natural gas last year. And the prices for natural gas have skyrocketed and been super volatile since 2020. So this kind of, this reliance on imported natural gas worked for a while pre-2020, but now it's really come back to bite us in the butt, and it's driven up utility prices. And so that's right now, contributing to this big inflation in utility bills, which people are seeing, and what the bill is going to do is, attack all the or cut all the tax credits and investment that these utilities were relying on to transition to cheaper forms of energy that are produced locally and that are more reliable during storms. And that is going to make them more dependent on natural gas, which is becoming more expensive. And the bill also makes it easier for U.S. fossil fuel companies to export their natural gas globally. And so, the bill's really written to reward the U.S. fossil fuel industry. And I think that's the main thing I would underscore for listeners is that, for states like Texas and Louisiana, given their self-interest, they have domestic industries they're trying to protect. They make a lot of money on fossil fuels. Like, that's just not the case in Florida. We don't produce fossil fuels. And so, Floridians should be very self-interested in this moment and see what's in this bill and recognize that it's going to hurt our utilities. We're seeing that in the stock market. Our utility rates are going up because we're relying on this gas. We're buying elsewhere. We did some of the numbers on how many billions of dollars we're sending each year out of state, and it's upwards of $10 billion that each year we send to other states to buy natural gas. And imagine if those funds were being invested locally to employ more Floridians, and pay them good jobs and, generate the energy locally so that, it's there are lower transmission costs and we have backup energy power during storms. And, so basically the bill is eliminating all the investments and tax credits and incentives that were helping our utilities and also helping homeowners and local governments and churches and schools, generate solar energy and, reduce their utility rates and become more resilient.
Yeah, and we have to note that, these tax benefits, you know, to get, you know, major utility providers in the state of Florida. You know, were absolutely necessary. I mean, they were dragged kicking and screaming, you know, into the, you know, 21st century of clean energy, you know, because for one thing, you know, they seem to, they own the, you know, the pipelines that, you know, I know FPNL does anyway, you know, that, you know, bring the natural gas to them. So, you know, they have a return on investment there. So the longer they use natural gas, you know, the better it is for them. And if they're allowed by the state, you know, to jack up the prices to cover, you know, jack up consumer costs, you know, to cover the increase in the cost of the gas to them, I mean, they still come out smelling like a rose. You know, but that
Lou,
is,
can I?
Yeah. Go ahead.
I mean, just on that point, you know, we're going to publish an article on Florida utilities and their reliance on natural gas pretty soon. But I started to look at the, you know, the filings from the Public Service Commission and look at their, you know, SEC filings for how much profit they're getting, and then also looking at, you know, how that tracks with natural gas pricing. And you're exactly right. I mean, the correlation between natural gas pricing and NextEra's, you know, Florida Power and Light's parent company, I mean, their profits track almost exactly with the price of natural gas. So to your point, you know, it's immensely profitable for them because they can pass all these fuel recovery costs on directly onto consumers. And, you know, they're still taking their, you know, PSC approved profit rate. And if, you know, if their fuel costs are way, way, way higher, you know, it's jacking up their profits.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I guess the point is that, you know, as smart as it seems, you know, considering we do live in the Sunshine State, you know, to harness the power of the sun rather than import natural gas, you know, these guys seem to have, you know, another emphasis or another reason why, you know, they want to keep this old school way, so that, you know, and I say to people who say, you know, government can't help with these problems or can't push people in the right direction, you know, I guess this is a clear case of showing that they're wrong. You know, that you give these guys tax incentives and, you know, they will, you know, change, right? I mean, this is, and that was the whole point of it. That was the whole point of the Inflation Reduction Act. That was the whole point of the CHIPS Act and the other big bills that were passed by the, you know, Biden administration to do good and not to give billionaires tax breaks, I guess. I digress. Mm-hmm. you know, this shift at, you know, and, you know, your cleaner energy option, you know, was even starting to gain traction too. I mean, that was something that I've been watching, you know, since I've moved to Florida, which is over 30 years ago, you know, and always baffled me, that it wasn't used more often, but it was starting to gain traction, right? I mean, they were, you know, building more facilities, and like what you said earlier, they were counting on those tax breaks to continue the projects, because this stuff doesn't happen overnight, right? I mean, it's...
Yeah, they were taking advantage of it because it made economic sense, you know? I mean, yes, on one hand, they are profiting immensely from natural gas, and so for them, you know, the incentive prior to the IRA was really not there because they could still make plenty of profit, and they didn't need to change their business plan. But after the IRA, you know, you really started to see an acceleration in, you know, in-state solar investment from, you know, all parts of, you know, not just in the utility sector, but, you know, schools and local governments and nonprofits and churches and, you know, all sorts of entities starting to take advantage of these new tax incentives and also, you know, direct investment from, new programs at the Environmental Protection Agency to make direct investment in, you know, Seminole Electric Cooperative Utility and, you know, the Solar for All Fund and, you know, all these different programs that growing a local industry here that meant that we weren't sending all that money out of state and, creating a lot more utility scale solar and, you know, we're starting to see it ramped up, and, you know, FPL announcing it's going to, you know, make all these investments through 2045. And I think we'll see what happens now. I mean, we'll see what happens as the bill moves forward in the coming days. But, you know, the people have already put together projections on which states stand to lose the most. And, you know, the projections based on – this was based on the original House bill that came out. But, you know, the projection is that Florida would lose the second most in the IRA repeal behind Texas. You know, and that it'd be something like 32,000 or 31,000 megawatts. We'd have 31,000 megawatts less in solar under the repeal, and that, you know, that would be 60% less than what's currently planned. So it would be a big reduction in in-state investment and jobs, you know, and you know, local solar energy that is right now the cheapest form of energy to produce.
Okay. You know, right now I just want to let listeners who are just tuning in, this is WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And I'm speaking with Ethan Frye, a research fellow at the Florida Policy Institute. You had mentioned earlier that, you know, schools and churches and other institutions, you know, are going to be big losers if this goes through. And, you know, and I guess, you know, for one reason is that there are efforts, you know, in this bill, you know, to claw back some of the money that was already authorized, even though, you know, I guess that's been stopped by the Senate parliamentarian, you know, but, you know, we don't know how that's going to play out. How else would school budgets be affected? I mean, it's just, you know, they were promised money and it wasn't dispersed, I guess. I mean, that's part of the state's part on the state, right?
Yeah, I mean, the state's sending money back, but I think the biggest loss will be the elimination of the clean energy production tax credits, you know, so this is for schools who don't already have solar panels on their facilities. You know, they can install solar and get, you know, 30 to 50 or 60% of the cost of the solar installation. They can get that picked up by the federal government through direct pay tax credits. And so that means that that amount of money is coming back into the school district to help with, you know, any number of budget needs. And there are a bunch of good examples of other school districts where, you know, they had taken advantage of this and used the funds to increase teacher pay, you know, to improve school facilities, to improve the HVAC system, to make investments in, you know, to close budget gaps, you know, given where we are with the school funding crisis in the state and how much money is now going to private vouchers. But this was, you know, a big source of funding. And then I think school buses is the second big, you know, big issue. I mean, with extreme heat and extreme storms on the rise, you know, and affecting all parts of the state, you know, the clean school bus funding was a great program, and you saw all different kinds of counties taking advantage of it. So, you know, buses were going not just to places like Miami-Dade, but also to Dixie County, you know, which took, you know, I forget the precise amount. I mean, so far, the state of Florida has received $106 million in EPA Clean School Bus Program awards. And so that basically funds the school district to buy a fleet of electric buses, which come with air conditioning, which is, you know, important in this hot state of ours. And so Dixie County in North Central Florida got 23 new electric school buses and a charging station. And so that's, you know, helping them cover the cost of, you know, new buses they have to buy and replace, and the maintenance costs on those are much lower. And then they're also using those buses to power backup or, you know, storm shelters during hurricanes. So, you know, those buses have a huge battery pack, and, you know, that comes in handy during storms. So, you know, these programs are all going to be – there's still can't remember exactly. I think it's $3.3 billion left in the clean school bus program. So,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
We'd be looking at, you know, significant more investment in the state. And, you know, they're looking to claw back that funding and other unobligated funding, and so that's really tough.
You know, and so people know that we aren't just dollars and cents people. As you noted in your report, you know, 37 children on average die each year of vehicular heat stroke, and that's something that could be, you know, greatly diminished, I guess, if you had air-conditioned buses.
Yeah. Yeah, school bus drivers, young children. I mean, you know, extreme heat affects, you know, people who work outdoors or in under-conditioned buses, agricultural workers, outdoor workers. Young children, you know, are especially vulnerable. And so, you know, having the federal government pay to transition over to electric buses and pay for them directly and, you know, make that investment in children's lives and their academic performance and, you know, and also protect the school bus drivers at the same time seems like a really great program.
Yeah, you know, and you know, let's not leave homeowners out of this. You know, they're going to lose a bunch of money, too, you know, based on, you know, by the way, an expansion of a program that was introduced by George W. Bush or established by George W. Bush in like 2005, and they expanded it. You know, I mean, it seems, you know, according to what I'm looking at right now, about $1 billion per year for subsidies for rooftop solar and energy efficiency tax credits. So homeowners, you know, are going to hurt too, right? I mean, that's...
Yeah, and I think that's what maybe most people don't recognize with the IRA, that, you know, the tax credits for rooftop solar and energy efficiency were established way back in 2005 by George W. Bush, a Republican. The IRA just expanded those, and in 2023, Florida homeowners took in about $1 billion in tax credits. And tax credit savings for efficiency improvements, rooftop solar, clean energy vehicles, et cetera. We don't have 2024 data, but, you know, imagine it's something similar to that. And, you know, and that doesn't include all kinds of other investments coming in from other IRA programs that are trying to improve the, you know, the infrastructure around people's homes to try and address extreme storm risk and flooding. And, you know, I think some of the major drivers right now of, you know, increased insurance costs and increased housing costs, you know, and so part of this is tied up in the reconciliation bill, but part of this is just moving independent of that. But I think I wanted to cover it in the article I wrote. I think, you know, the main targets in the reconciliation bill are the cuts to NOAA and its Coastal Communities and Climate Resilience Program, and, you know, some money for the Department of Agriculture to try and improve nature-based solutions and urban tree canopies and things like that. So a lot of those investments were really just trying to address the, you know, address extreme heat and address extreme weather and flooding, you know, which are impacting people's homes, you know, and threatening property, threatening people's lives. And so we're looking at lots of cuts to those programs. But then, you know, kind of moving simultaneous with this reconciliation bill is what's happening with the disaster recovery system and Trump's calling to dismantle FEMA at the end of the year after hurricane season. And, you know, Florida, not surprisingly, is receiving the most amount from FEMA. We've gotten $14.3 billion from FEMA alone since 2015, and that doesn't include, you know, several billion dollars on top of that that's coming from HUD for disaster recovery. And so I think all, you know, all told, you know, what the reconciliation bill is cutting from the tax credits for homeowners to try and, you know, improve their homes, have backup energy power, you know, have rooftop solar, make efficiency improvements, things that can, you know, drop your utility costs, drop your insurance rates. And then, you know, the attacks on the disaster recovery system, you know, which are really trying to address, you know, all this flooding and impacts to life and property and, you know, reduce the cost of these storms and bring down insurance rates, you know, those are really going to hurt.
Yeah, well, On that note, I really want to thank you, Ethan Frey, for making time for us today and for, you know, doing this, you know, really detailed and great analysis, you know, that you know, Florida Policy Institute, I guess, is becoming famous for. And we are, of course, you know, coming into hurricane season, and it's starting earlier and earlier and lasting longer and longer. So, you know, these are things that I guess people are going to have to be aware of. Thanks again, Ethan, and you have a great day.
Thanks, Lou. You too. Take care.
Right. Bye.
An Iran-linked hacker group is claiming to be in possession of a trove of stolen emails from President Donald Trump's inner circle and is now threatening to publish the material in what U.S. officials describe as a politically motivated smear campaign. The group operating under the alias Robert said it has over 100 gigabytes of emails from key Trump allies, including White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles, longtime confidant Roger Stone, Trump attorneys Lindsey Halligan, and even adult film actress Stormy Daniels. Reuters broke this story this week after direct communication with the hackers, who hinted at potentially selling the material through the group, though the group offered no specifics. The threat comes just days after Trump abruptly reversed a tentative effort to ease sanctions on Iran following Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khomeini downplaying of U.S. and Israeli strikes on the Iranian nuclear facilities. A top Iranian cleric has issued a fatwa against Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, calling the pair enemies of God. This so-called cyber attack is nothing more than digital propaganda, said Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency spokesperson Marcy McCarthy. She described the effort as a calculated smear campaign designed to damage President Trump and discredit honorable public servants. The hackers claim that the breach was triggered by recent U.S. involvement in the 12-day conflict between Israel and Iran, a war Trump claimed credit for ending via a negotiated ceasefire. Despite claiming to have halted new attacks, the group says it resumed operations in response to that military intervention. Federal prosecutors have already linked the hacker group to Iran. According to Axios, a 2024 indictment charged three Iranian nationals involved in the Robert Group for their role in earlier breach of Trump systems, explicitly tying their operation to the Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. St. Petersburg had hundreds of thousands of people celebrating Pride at its 23rd annual Pride Festival. The St. Pete Pride Festival is considered to be the largest in Florida. Organizers reported that more than 350,000 people attended the event. "This is probably the biggest I've ever seen," said Jamal Arth, an attendee. "Love is love," said Brian Nugent, an attendee. "For many, Pride is about love, peace, and feeling at home. It's important to celebrate so when they see representation, so they know that there's other people out there like me, so I don't feel so alone in the world," said Alexis Kimbrell, another attendee. "Pride means for me, I mean, it's who I am, really," said Bree Texera, another attendee. Richard Randall said for him, "Pride is about celebrating freedom, diversity, and how far we've come as a society. When Pride first started, when I lived in Chicago, my boyfriend at the time, he was a bit older, he was afraid to hold hands with me in public," said Randall. "And to be able to see how we've grown shows how important things like this are, so that we are all known that we have freedom to be who we want to be." The Pride Festival included a trans march and a parade. But not only is it a fun event for everyone to enjoy, it's also a vital source of income for hundreds of local vendors, caterers, artists, and community partners. Organizers said the event generates nearly $63 million through direct and indirect spending. And people keep coming back every year for a reason. To be around individuals with, like, good vibes, good food, good music just came out to celebrate the day, said Dion Lindsay, an attendee. One told ABC Action News Annette Gutierrez that they just got married and have attended at least 5 Pride parades. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.5